We're discussing vaccine rollout with advocate Aurora Health, which has one of its headquarters in Milwaukee and operates 26 hospitals. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The CDC data tracker shows Wisconsin is one of the leading states for administering the highest percentage of COVID vaccines received. But hospitals and clinics, they're struggling to get enough doses to meet demand. Advocate Aurora Health has administered nearly 232,000 vaccines to date. Have you been vaccinated? What is it like to get an appointment? Do you have questions about your eligibility and where to get vaccinated? 800-642-1234. Dr. Jeff Barr is an internal medicine specialist and president of Aurora Healthcare Medical Group. He's on the board of the Wisconsin Hospital Association. Dr. Barr, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning, Kay. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with your health system first. How are you prioritizing? How are you deciding who gets a vaccine and who doesn't?
Well, there's been a shift since we started the vaccine program in mid-December. We've worked through all of our healthcare frontline team members, so physicians, nurses, anyone who touches patients, and with an emphasis on our employees. But we also administered vaccinations to many healthcare workers outside our own system in that 1A category. And now we're in the 1B category. So we're really dealing with individuals 65 and older who are at high risk for contracting the disease and having a bad outcome from the disease. So if you're 65 or over and you have severe comorbidities, as we call them, so think diabetes, lung disease, cancer, things of those types, you're going to be prioritized over individuals without those comorbidities. We've also turned our focus to certain communities that are predisposed to contracting the disease at higher rates and who are predisposed to having bad outcomes from the disease itself.
This latest group that is able to get vaccinized, including teachers in this group, this is hundreds of thousands of people who are now eligible. What do your vaccine, how many vaccines are you getting and are you able to get enough?
Well, so I think you touched on it in your introduction. Demand far exceeds supply, not just in southeastern Wisconsin, not just in the state as a whole, but really across the nation. Large healthcare organizations like Advocate Aurora and really every entity that is administering the vaccine at the local level does not have enough supply to meet demand. And so that's why we are tiering the recipients of the vaccine into prioritized categories like that. And I really don't know of any group that is administering the vaccine that would say, yes, we've got enough. We're confident we will. So I think, as I mentioned, we just started doing this in December, and we'd like to be further ahead than we are, but I don't want that to cast a pall over the progress that we've made. As you mentioned, our organization alone has vaccinated over 230,000 people in Illinois and Wisconsin as of yesterday. In Wisconsin alone, we've vaccinated over 111,000 individuals. So we feel very good about that because we know that this is our path out of the pandemic. But we'd like to be a lot further, a lot faster.
Dr. Barr, how do you flex with the supply changes week to week, or maybe there aren't? I mean, to ensure you don't waste any doses.
Yeah, in a word, nimbly. We have to be nimble. We don't know what our supply is going to be. We are reliant on federal and state agencies to let us know how much of which product we're going to get and when, and then at the county level, how those supplies are going to be distributed. Fortunately, I would say that across the state of Wisconsin, the healthcare organizations that are administering the vaccine have demonstrated excessive amounts of cooperation and collaboration with one another to get our state to its highest point of health throughout the pandemic. So I'm very pleased with that. I'm very pleased with our relationship with government at every level. I think the communication has, even if it's not the news we want about the amount of supply we're going to get, at least it's the communication is there. And so I think that helps.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Barr, who is president of Aurora Healthcare Medical Group on the board of the Wisconsin Hospital Association. We're discussing vaccine rollout at Aurora and talking with you. Have you been vaccinated? What is it like to get an appointment after receiving the vaccine? Did you have any side effects? How long did they last? What do you tell your friends and neighbors about getting vaccinated? 800-642-1234. You mentioned communication, Dr. Barr. How do you schedule patients for appointments with this vaccine? Is there a waiting list? How do you reach out?
So we don't maintain a waiting list of any sort. And really, we've tried to contact our patients and our team members in a variety of ways. I'd say the most effective way is what we call our LiveWell app. Advocate Aurora uses a digital app that allows patients to receive an invitation to schedule that first dose. You come in for that first dose, and if it is a two-dose vaccine, now that we have a single-dose vaccine, we have to distinguish. But if it's a two-dose vaccine, you're eligible to schedule that second dose immediately after that first dose is administered and registered in our system. So we are providing outreach to our established patients, and those are individuals that have really maintained care with us at some point in some form in the last 2 years. And so we are going through our electronic medical record and providing outreach either through our app or by email. At the end of the day, if we find that people have not shown for their appointments and we do have doses left over, we do use our contact center, our centralized contact centers, to provide telephone calls to patients who would be otherwise eligible also. So there's a variety of ways. I would also say that for those that are not digitally proficient, individuals who come in for their regular appointments with their primary care physicians or other clinicians that they might see in our system, we have a pilot going on at several of our clinic locations by which they can schedule that appointment live in person with our staff at those clinic locations after their normal healthcare appointments.
Let's look for a moment at the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, one-dose sure. vaccine, and the state is expecting to get thousands of doses. When do you expect Aurora Health beginning to offer the Johnson & Johnson vaccine?
We're still waiting to hear that right
okay.
now. So that's a conversation in process right now. We're hopeful it'll be sooner rather than later.
What do you make of a one-dose vaccine? Does it allow you to be more flexible?
Without a doubt, it's a game changer because number one, it adds to our supply. So we're able to vaccinate a greater number of people. And you probably know that there the storage constraints of the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines in terms of temperature maintenance don't exist with the J&J vaccine. And given that it's a single dose, you don't have to worry about someone coming back for their second appointment because unfortunately we have had individuals that show for the first appointment and, you know, by one mechanism or another, may not be able to make that second appointment that they set. And it's uncommon, but it's happened. And I think the J&J vaccine mitigates that issue.
Wow. So, I mean, that would be a concern if patients don't or if people don't show up for that second vaccine.
Without a doubt. And so we stress through every communication, look, if it's the Moderna or Pfizer product, you're committing to a two-dose vaccine process. And like I said, the second dose no-show is rare, but we want to educate people about the implications of that and making sure that we're not wasting vaccine in that way either.
Internal medicine specialist Jeff Barr with us, heads up medical group operations for Aurora Healthcare. Do you work at a hospital or clinic? Are you still waiting to get vaccinated? Healthcare workers, what are you experiencing with COVID cases and your patient load? Are you able to vaccinate your patients yet? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Barr here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we discuss vaccine rollout in health systems. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're zooming in on Advocate Aurora Health, which is vaccinating healthcare workers and its most vulnerable patients based on CDC guidelines. It has more than 75,000 workers, hundreds of locations in Wisconsin and Illinois. Clinicians, how accessible is information about who's eligible for the vaccine? What are frequent misconceptions that you work to dispel about COVID vaccines? Is your healthcare clinic able to flex and administer all the doses you receive in a given week? 800-642-1234. Dr. Jeff Barr is president of Aurora Healthcare Medical Group, and he stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Julie now in Wausau. Hi, Julie. What is your question?
Hi, I am part of a project here in central Wisconsin where we are organizing several organizations to get information out to the Hmong and Hispanic communities about COVID. In spring, we were getting information about testing and quarantine and all of that, and now we've moved to trying to get information out about the vaccine. And what we are encountering here is that the websites, whether they're pharmacies or health systems or even health departments, are all in English. Mm. And if people can get through the website and actually schedule an appointment, the call that they get back is from an English speaker. Mm. And I just kind of want to point out to the doctor that this is a serious issue here in our part of the state. And I'm wondering if Aurora is doing anything to address people
language barriers.
English is not language, yes.
Yeah, Julie, thank you. Language barriers and, you know, undeniable disparities related to COVID. What is Advocate Aurora Health's position on this, Dr. Barr?
Yeah, great question, and I'm glad you raised it. I think this really aligns well with our overall diversity, equity, and inclusion work at a system level, not just relative to COVID, but relative to healthcare in general. But on the COVID front, we've hosted several Spanish language Facebook Live sessions that have been very, very popular, not just in Wisconsin, but in Illinois as well. And much of our literature that we provide our patients is available in multiple languages, including Hmong, Spanish, Russian, and a variety of other languages. But you point out a good issue to resolve, and that is the disparity in language services across healthcare systems, not just in Wisconsin, but nationally. So we have taken that really head on in offering several education sessions, not just in written word, but also in social media.
Jill called from Madison, couldn't stay with us. Jill only wants to schedule an appointment to receive the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and not the other two. Do you see this being possible at all at Aurora? Do you have a choice of which vaccine you receive, Jill asks.
You know, given everything we've talked about, the vaccine supply continuing to be very limited nationally and our ability to vaccinate our patients, it's really based on whichever vaccine is shipped to us. And so for that reason, we, like most healthcare providers, are unable to offer patients a choice of vaccine. So we encourage people to get the vaccine that is first available to them, as they are all highly safe and effective. And mass vaccination, as I've mentioned, is really the only way to bring an end to the pandemic.
Russ now in Stoughton is with us. Hi, Russ. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I'm 74 years old. About 6 weeks ago, I think it was January, there was an article in our local Senior Citizens monthly newsletter for Stoughton, Wisconsin, to register to get on a list for in coordination with Stoughton Health and UW-Madison Hospital to get on a list to make an appointment for a vaccine shot, you know, whatever type. And so about 3 weeks ago, I called them afterwards and tried to find out where I was on the list. Well, they didn't know that. So just 2 days ago, I called them to find out what was going on. Were they going to contact me? Are they getting down to my name or whatever? They said they hadn't received any vaccine for 2 weeks and didn't know if they were going to get any more in the future.
No, oh, so Russ is feeling pretty high and dry here, as had signed up and now comes to find out not able to get vaccinated through this outlet. Have you heard of this concern, Dr. Barr?
Absolutely, and it's I'm sorry that you had to go through that first and foremost, because it's kind of a hurry up and wait mentality and that we're all forced to be in then. And as I mentioned earlier, we don't maintain a wait list. The last thing we want to do is get people scheduled, get them in a queue, only to cancel on them. And so we try to restrict our scheduling process until we know with certainty that we're going to have supply because as the caller mentioned, Russ, it can be very disappointing to have to go through that. You make the decision to get the vaccination, and for a lot of people, that can be quite a difficult decision to make. Now, I think with the safety information coming out, it's an easier decision. But a lot of people ruminate on the decision in the first place, and then you get signed up, and then your appointment's canceled because there's no supply. And so we try to avoid that by only scheduling people when we know with certainty that we have that supply.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Barr, who's president of Aurora Healthcare Medical Group. We're looking at how vaccines are being administered through his health system, which has one of its headquarters in Milwaukee, and looking at the greater vaccine rollout with your questions, 800-642-1234. Rich is joining us from Rhinelander. Rich, go ahead.
Hi. A greeting is emerging among people. The other night, my neighbor's dogs and my dog started feeling springtime and running around together, so Chris came over. He and his wife, Julie, live across the road. And the first words we said to one another, because I go back and forth between Jefferson County and Oneida County all the time, first words were, "Hi, Chris, I've been vaccinated." He said, "I have too, Rich. I got really sick. Did you get sick from it?" I said, "Not at all." My point is Wisconsin is doing a wonderful job of reaching certain communities. Like, I'm very old. I'm about 50 years older than Chris and his wife. I think we really have to start emphasizing we need to Chris and Julie work in geriatric healthcare, the paper end of it up here in Oneida County. We really have to start vaccinating young people as quickly as we can. And I think we also need some sort of system of communicating who's been vaccinated and who has not. I know there are dangers in that, but I don't want to sound like some kind of fascist with armbands or badges, but I think we need some way of saying, hey, it's all right to get vaccinated.
Rich, thank you for those observations and sharing about your neighbors as well. Dr. Barr, what are your reflections on what Rich has to say?
Well, I think it's great that we're getting the vaccines out to communities throughout the state, first and foremost. And I think the scale of organizations like mine, Advocate Aurora's scale, allows us to do that very, as I mentioned earlier, nimbly. I do want to preach caution. The vaccine, even if everybody were vaccinated, there'd still be some concern that some people could still get infected. Certainly, even once we reach herd immunity, there's still going to be some cases cropping up here because the vaccines are not 100% efficacious. So that distancing, the masking, and all the other public health mitigation measures become very, very important, no matter how far into the pandemic we go. So I'm glad people are getting vaccinated. I'm glad people are conversing about it and encouraging one another to do it. And I couldn't agree more. Let's get the whole population vaccinated to do that. It all comes back to supply.
Well, Dr. Barr, let's break that down a little bit. If you are vaccinated, your neighbor across the street is vaccinated, and what can you and cannot you do? I mean, can I break that down for us?
Well, I think it's not a passport to go about life as though it were 2019 again. I do think that vaccinated individuals, we believe, still have the ability to transmit the virus to unvaccinated individuals. And that's why we still promote masking, distancing, cleanliness, things of that type. I think gradually, as the percentage of vaccinated individuals in the state climbs, we are going to be able to ease up, but we're not there yet.
Let's look a little bit at your patient load and what the hospitals are looking like for Aurora. How are COVID-positive patients admitted to the hospital? What numbers are you seeing?
Well, we're very encouraged at the numbers over the last month or two. Right, as of yesterday, in our hospitals in Wisconsin, and Advocate Aurora operates 16 hospitals in the eastern third of Wisconsin, we had only 55 COVID-positive patients in our hospitals. That's a phenomenal number to realize. It's a significant drop from really just 3 months ago. And If you look at the positivity rates of our tests, they're at levels lower than at any point since we've been testing. So also very, very encouraging. So if you look at people that are getting tested before a procedure or a surgery, those rates are going way down also. But just basic community testing is going down also.
Very quickly, what is your greatest challenge right now?
You know, it's twofold. It's making sure that we as a community, we as a kind of statewide brotherhood of community members, that we stay vigilant about ending our purpose to end this vaccine. So I'm saying end the pandemic,
yeah,
and promote vaccination. So that's a challenge right now, is just maintaining vigilance among people. I think people are COVID fatigued, and vigilance tends to wane a little bit as time goes on. The other challenge is something we haven't really talked a lot about, and that's kind of the so-called second pandemic of unintended chronic health conditions, behavioral health conditions, preventative measures. I'd be remiss if I didn't point out, this is March's National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. And we need to make sure that people are not ignoring basic cancer screening.
And all the screenings. And Dr. Barr, we are out of time. I just want to thank you, Dr. Jeff Barr, an internist and president of Aurora Healthcare Medical Group. Coming up, our discussion on COVID vaccines continues. Stay with us. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we discuss the arrival of the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now there are 3 vaccine supply lines nationwide, so the pace of shots into arms will likely accelerate rapidly in coming weeks. And the new J&J shot only requires 1 dose, but a recent Kaiser Family Foundation poll found about 1 in 5 adults is taking a wait-and-see approach to the vaccine before getting vaccinated. How much have you heard about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? What questions do you have about it? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. William Hartman is an anesthesiologist at UW Health and an assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's principal investigator for the UW AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine trial. Dr. Hartman, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the Johnson & Johnson newly approved vaccine, they had revealed data showing this vaccine, while highly productive, had a slightly lower efficacy rate than the first shots produced by Moderna and Pfizer. So can you clear this up for us? What are the concerns here?
Well, I don't know that there's any concerns necessarily. It's hard to compare the two vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, because they were tested at different times.
Mm.
So the mRNA vaccines were tested at a time where the variants weren't very prevalent, especially the variant in South Africa. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine was about 72% effective in the U.S., but then in the worldwide trial, it was lower, around 66%, likely because of the effect of that South African variant in there. And so all of these vaccines are going to have a slightly lower efficacy against that particular variant. At least that's what's been seen so far. And so it's difficult to compare the efficacy one, you know, apples to apples.
It's not apples to apples. Okay.
Correct. I think that what we have to look at, though, is the end result. That being that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is just as effective as the EUA vaccines that are currently approved in terms of preventing
emergency correct. Youth authorization. Go ahead.
Especially in preventing severe disease, hospitalizations, and death, which is really the goal of these vaccines, to prevent death from COVID-19.
So both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are mRNA vaccines. What does that mean?
So the mRNA vaccines, it's a slightly newer platform in which the vaccines really just contain the message or the note that gets passed to the cells to make the spike protein. They are a very simple vaccine that just has that mRNA message encoded in kind of a protective layer of lipids so that it can get into the cells.
And so the
Johnson
Yeah, the Johnson & Johnson injects viral DNA, not mRNA. How is that possible, and how does the J&J able to do that in a single dose?
So the J&J vaccine is an adenovirus vaccine, and so it's it uses the cell's machinery to turn on the system to make the spike protein. So the end result is the same as the mRNA vaccines. It just goes about it in a different way. And because of that slightly different platform and using the adenovirus kind of base, if you will, to make the vaccine, it allows the body to both prime and build that long-lasting immunity that we're hoping happens with these vaccines.
You know, this is one dose. Will that change your thinking or your approach on how we can deploy these vaccines?
Well, it's not just that it's a one-dose vaccine. It's also an inexpensive vaccine to make, and it's a very easy vaccine to store. It just requires normal refrigeration temperatures. And so it's a vaccine that can be deployed to every corner of our state, every corner of the country, and really reach all parts of the world because of its simplicity. And so I think that will change the way that the vaccines are deployed so that they can reach further parts of the state, make it easier for people to have access to a vaccine. And because it's only one shot, it makes a big difference in terms of if the state of Wisconsin, for instance, is getting 47,000 vaccines, that means 47,000 vaccinations. So we'll be able to ramp up the process of getting vaccines in people's arms.
Talking with Dr. Bill Hartman, anesthesiologist at UW Health and assistant professor at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, we're looking at the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, taking your questions about it. Have you been vaccinated? What do you want to know about the differences between vaccines? Do you have any questions about how they are administered or what they do? Join in at 800-642-1234. Lori has a question in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Lori, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. One question that I cannot find the answer to is, how do the three COVID vaccines compare as preventing mild to moderate disease? I'm 62, I have high blood pressure, so I'm not eligible for the vaccine yet, but I'm very concerned about even getting a mild, moderate case of it. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thank you, Lori. Go ahead, Dr. Hartman.
Sure. And so I think what we have to remember with vaccines is that the purpose of the vaccines is to prevent you from getting sick from a virus. It doesn't necessarily prevent you from contracting the virus, but they're very good at preventing you from getting sick from the virus. And at this point, when we talk about those efficacy rates, we're really talking about the efficacy in preventing the symptomatic COVID or the mild to moderate COVID that you're talking about. And so the efficacy of the mRNA vaccines, the Moderna and the Pfizer, is quite high, somewhere in that 94% to 95%. The efficacy, at least as far as we know with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine right now, is about 75%. So if you compare that to, say, the influenza vaccine, which is somewhere around 45% to 55% effective, these are all very, very effective vaccines in preventing you from getting symptomatic disease and even more so at preventing the hospitalizations and the death that can occur with COVID-19.
We're seeing the emergence of these highly contagious variants of the virus. What is the likelihood that these new the J&J vaccine will protect people from these other variants?
Well, I think that's something that is really ongoing. We're learning more about these variants as they arise. The South African variant in particular seems to be very well characterized at this point. And the vaccines are less effective against preventing symptomatic COVID from one of these variant forms of from the South African variant form of COVID. And so while it's less effective, what we're doing is we're trying to figure out strategies to attack it. And so Moderna has created a booster shot that has a sequence for the variant, the South African variant COVID, so that you can attack that particular spike protein. Pfizer has asked the question, can we just boost the immune system with a third dose of their vaccine to overwhelm the variants with your own immunity?
Hmm.
Johnson & Johnson is actually looking at an approach similar to that, where they would go to a two-shot instead of just a one-shot vaccine. But at this point, where we are in the U.S., they still feel the one-shot vaccine provides enough protection, and the other vaccines are doing the same regimens that they were approved as.
Okay, let's bring in Tracy now in Door County with a question. Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is just, I'm curious to know what vaccine would be the best one for someone who has underlying autoimmune issues. Thank you. And I'll take the answer off the call.
Yeah, Tracy, thank you. So underlying autoimmune disease, what are your insights there on these vaccines?
So there's different types of autoimmune diseases. And so it's best to talk it over with your primary physician so that your particular case can be discussed. But in general, getting any one of the vaccines at this point will be beneficial, because even reduced immunity is better than no immunity. And so people with underlying autoimmune diseases aren't going to have the same robust response to these vaccines as a person without the autoimmune disease. But again, having some level of immunity is still better than having no immunity at all. So the recommendation is to get any one of these vaccines as they come available. But again, that's an important topic to bring up with your primary care physician so that your particular case can be discussed and all your questions can be answered.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Hartman of UW Health, fielding questions from you about the COVID vaccines, the arrival of the new Johnson & Johnson vaccine, what that means. What do you think about having a one-dose vaccine? Do you think you'd prefer one dose or two? Are you eligible to receive the vaccine? Can you book an appointment and where? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Hartman here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Bill Hartman of UW Health. While the approval of three COVID vaccines is a glimmer of hope, the rollout of these vaccines so far has been slower than expected. We're discussing the intricacies of the new Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the status of clinical trials for future vaccines on the horizon, and Dr. Hartman is with us for 10 more minutes. Mark is joining us from Kimberly. Hi, Mark.
Hi. In the journal Science, there's a report of a nasal spray last one day, like 100% effective in the ferrets, the animals they were testing it in as far as stopping transmission. And it anchors to the nasal cells or even deeper in the lung with a cholesterol molecule. It's part of the thing. And it's completely non-toxic in their tests. They say it doesn't interact with the human cells. It interacts with the virus, and it interacts with the more inner part of the virus. And all of these variations, this adaptation, that mutation that the virus does to defeat us, is more in these spike proteins, but the inner part is more stable, and this they call it, you know, somebody called it a molecular mask.
Well, Mark, let's get Dr. Hartman's insights on the development of a nasal spray.
Well, I think in terms of the vaccines, they are looking at some non-injectable forms of vaccines, so that you know, there's people that are scared of the needle itself and the process of getting an injection. And so we have to figure out ways to get everybody who wants a vaccine a vaccine. And so if we can come up with ways that don't require a needle, don't require an injection, that's obviously a real plus. I think what you're talking about, Mark, is something more of an antiviral treatment, however. So not necessarily a vaccine, but something that will attack the virus itself. And you have to remember, a year ago at this time, we didn't have any treatments at all. And so we've slowly been, not even slowly, it's been a pretty fast process, but figuring out ways to attack this virus on different levels.
Yeah.
Through, say, convalescent plasma or monoclonal antibodies, remdesivir. And so it's very exciting, actually, that some of these aerosols, like the one that you described, are coming to fruition, so that we can have different ways to attack the virus. The best way to attack any of these viruses is to have a multimodal approach and to go about it by attacking at different levels, so that the virus can't make mutations or variations to one particular treatment. And so I think that's an excellent point that you've brought up.
Yeah, Mark, thank you. Let's bring in Kathy now in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Kathy, go ahead.
Hi, I've read that there have been 4 different medical studies of asymptomatic people so far, and all of them have found that even in asymptomatic people, there's lung damage. And at first they didn't know why, when there's no cough, and et cetera, but then they found that there's an acid that's naturally present in the lungs, something in the lining. And when you have COVID, even asymptomatic, this acid multiplies and scars the lungs. And my question is, isn't it true, since the vaccine doesn't prevent you from getting the disease, only manages symptoms or keeps them, from becoming severe, wouldn't that lung damage still be happening in people who get the vaccine and then go on to get COVID?
Well, Kathy, I think that's an excellent question. And I do think that the vaccines are going to help prevent some of these asymptomatic cases that we would see otherwise, because you're still getting a pretty reasonable amount of antibody, generated antibody, into your nasal mucosa to trap that virus and neutralize it before it ever even gets to the lungs. And we don't know what level that antibody is at this point. It's still being studied, but the presumption is that we'll be able to hopefully neutralize the virus before it can get to the lungs and cause any damage. These viruses, they have to be able to link up with the human cells to start to multiply and cause the damage that you see and that you're talking about. So if we can neutralize it by developing antibodies to the spike proteins which cause that anchoring to the cells, then certainly we hope to prevent some of these effects of the virus that like what you're talking about.
Let's spend a moment here on the AstraZeneca trial, which you're the principal investigator for UW School of Medicine and Public Health. What is the status of this vaccine trial?
So this vaccine trial, the enrollment phase is completed in the United States. And so we've had about 31,000 to 32,000 participants nationwide. We're going through the process of collecting the data so that we know who developed COVID-19, symptomatic COVID-19 within our trial population, as well as the side effect profile, to make sure that it's safe and effective. And we're putting that report together, and hopefully by the middle of this month, we'll have a very good idea of what the efficacy is here in the United States, the safety profile, and the goal, if all the numbers look promising, would be to submit for emergency use authorization sometime at the beginning of next month.
how long would the trial continue after the reporting stage, after the submission of the emergency youth authorization?
So the trial itself actually goes on for 2 years.
Okay.
And the reason for that is so that we can follow these participants for a couple of reasons. Number one, we want to know how long the immunity lasts. And so how long do they have a robust antibody response? How long are these antibodies around? And so we'll bring these participants back every few months to measure their antibody level to see at what point do we have to give a booster shot, if we need to give a booster shot. And then also, some individuals have elected to get a vaccine booster on top of these, on top of the AstraZeneca vaccine. And so we want to know, does that give further robustness to their overall antibody response, and compare that to people who don't get the booster. And so there's a lot of ongoing investigation that's still very important, as we don't have all of the story written yet.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Hartman, who's an anesthesiologist, principal investigator on this COVID AstraZeneca vaccine trial at the UW. Bob is joining us from Clay Banks with a question. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. I was wondering how they exposed people in the trials to the virus.
So that's a very good question, because early in the planning stages, they had discussed maybe even exposing people to the virus itself. But the virus is so prevalent, and it was so prevalent even in our own state, that we never had to come to that. So just by people going about and living as they normally would, doing all the things of social distancing, wearing a mask, washing their hands, avoiding large crowds, but just living like they normally would with either the vaccine or the placebo on board. And just by the natural nature of the virus, some people are going to catch it and other people are not. And so we didn't have to do any other exposure other than people living their lives as they normally would.
I want to land here on convalescent plasma. The federal government discontinued a research trial of convalescent plasma for COVID after a study found the treatment does not stop patients from getting sicker. What are you seeing? What did UW Health learn from these trials?
So I think the overall presumption on convalescent plasma right now, and the way that the FDA has rewritten their emergency use authorization for it, is that high titer early use of convalescent plasma, so within the first 2 days of a person being hospitalized with COVID-19, is still proving to be an effective treatment at neutralizing the virus. Much beyond that, or if you use lower titer antibody convalescent plasma, it's not going to be as effective, especially as patients move towards needing higher amounts of oxygen and go into the ICU or need to be ventilated. Convalescent plasma has not shown to be advantageous in those situations. And so early use, high titer convalescent plasma is still an effective therapy for COVID-19.
Dr. Hartman, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Bill Hartman is an anesthesiologist at UW Health and an assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.